And now, Pastor Comparé.
And they did say that they expected him to come back again at some future time, again incarnated in human form. Now, it couldn't, of course, have been any race memory of the time when God appeared in human form as Jesus Christ, because remember, this was 2,000 years before Christ. But just the same, perhaps there is a little of this race memory coming in here when they say that God appeared to be their leader. Remember now, he didn't make himself in human form. He appeared as this tremendous column of fire by night and cloud by day to lead his people out of Egypt and into Palestine. So maybe they have some old race memory as a foundation for saying that their god Indra, God incarnated in human form, was their leader. And they did say that they expected him to come back again at some future time, again incarnated in human form. Now, it isn't clear, but it is worthy of perhaps some note that this could be a race memory of the prophecy that was given starting way back in the third chapter of Genesis, that God himself was coming as a man born a descendant of Eve to redeem his people. There's just a possibility there. And you would only find that among the Adamic people because the others didn't have the source of it. Now, you do find such race memories cropping up. You remember that in Genesis 3, verse 15, God says to Satan, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. And the same Hebrew word zerah is used in each case for seed or children. So Satan was to have just as literal children as Eve. I will put enmity between thy seed and her seed. He shall crush thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now, let's turn to the Greeks, the old pagan Greeks. You remember they had the legend of their great hero, Achilles. His mother was warned that he was going to be, when he was just a baby, he was going to be killed by an enemy in battle, unless she did one thing. If she could dip him in the waters of the river Styx, the river which flowed between the land of the living and the land of the dead, that would harden his skin to make it impenetrable to any weapon. So she went there and she dipped him in, but she held him by one heel that didn't get dipped. And therefore, that remained the one vulnerable part of his body. And he was killed, finally, by an enemy driving a spear into that heel, that one vulnerable spot. Unquestionably, among the pagan people. But remember now, our people, and with the racial memory of what their ancestors and ours had handed down, paganized now, appearing as a legend by pagan poets. But here, it was the heel that was going to be injured. You'll find another variant of it appearing among the old Germans when they were still pagan. The legend of their hero Siegfried. You remember that's a part of the legends that Wagner wove into a series of four operas, the Ring of the Nibelungen series. The great hero Siegfried had killed the dragon, a variant on your St. George and the Dragon beyond any possible doubt. And as the dying dragon was there, blood spouting from his throat cut by Siegfried's sword, Siegfried stepped into this stream of blood, and this blood shower bath hardened his skin to make it invulnerable against any weapon, except from a linden tree above, one leaf fluttered down, landed on his back in there between his shoulder blades, and kept the blood from hitting that spot. So he had one vulnerable place there, which Eventually, the villain Hagen, attacking him from behind, drove a spear into that one vulnerable spot and killed him. But you can see where, even after a people become paganized, the old race memories stay there. So it is probable that here again, their story about Indra as an incarnation of God, Indra himself may have been simply a human hero. Now, you know, among the Germans and Scandinavians, you had the gods Odin and Thor. Now, we know to an absolute certainty that they were great hero leaders in the course of the march diagonally across Europe up to the Baltic. We know where Odin finally made his home in Sweden and was buried. And incidentally, the genealogy of George Washington has been traced, and Odin is one of his ancestors. In fact, practically every royal house in Europe can trace their ancestry to Odin. But we know that he was a human warrior, statesman, leader, who finally was deified, as pagan custom was. Same was true of Thor. He was originally a military hero among them, and eventually their poets got around to making a pagan god of him. So there may be nothing more than that in Indra, that here was a very successful military leader, and eventually they deified him. But in the course of the process, the idea of saying that he was an incarnation of a god who came as their leader for a time, the only god, they said, there were no others, and eventually later he was going to be incarnated again to save his people. It shows that whether they were mistaken about who Indra was, they at least had the old race memory of what we have in the Bible. They left us the Sanskrit language, which is the parent language of what has been called the Indo-European group. Greek, Latin, with the four modern languages springing from Latin, Germanic, Anglo-Saxon, the old Anglo-Saxon differed very little from Low German, Icelandic, Celtic, and you find among the Iranian and even some of the Slavic languages a number of the Sanskrit words, showing that some of our people speaking this language had gotten in there, and although lost among some of these other races by mongrelization, they had left a trace of their language. Now remember, they were true to type. Here they came in as a military conquering people, forming a ruling aristocracy and raising civilization to a high pitch. That's what they've always done. Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, remember? And they have brought high civilization and imposed it by force upon the other races. Then they mongrelize, disappear, and the civilization falls. Now let's go on down to Babylon. You remember that back in the 2200s B.C., Babylon had achieved a pretty high civilization. King Hammurabi, who is referred to in your Bible as Amraphel, he left a law code that showed pretty thorough study and organization. It isn't God's law, but it's an attempt on the part of man to do a pretty good job with man's laws. And then, by a century after that, Babylon had slipped into unimportance for several centuries. Then about 1746 B.C., a nomadic people called the Kassites came in, conquered Babylon, held it to 1180 B.C. Now, the Babylonian was not one of this Sanskrit group of languages, and its names were not. But this Kassite group of kings, who brought it back to a pretty high civilization, had these Indo-European names derived from Sanskrit. Then the next thing we want to look at as an example of what our people did and then lost everything by mongrelization is Egypt. Now, people lived in the Nile Valley practically any number of thousands of years you want to name. There is one place in particular where one of the Egyptian dynasties, I forget which one, had left some great stone monuments carved as a monument to a particular pharaoh's vanity, and thereby they can date quite accurately when that stone monument was built there. And today, the earth has gradually built up around that, dust blowing in and settling, so that today's level of the soil is 10 feet higher than it was when that monument was set up. You have to dig down 10 feet to find the original base and the pavement surrounding it and so on. So if you assume that that is probably an average example of how fast the soil builds up, 10 feet in that many number of centuries, you have a basis for making a rough estimate of how much earlier something is that you find way down below the soil. And they have made test borings with core drills down to a depth exceeding 140 feet and have brought up Stone Age implements, obsidian knives, arrow and spearheads, and that kind of thing, that judging by the depth would indicate a dating of roughly 13,500 BC. But the point is that Egypt, as an organized nation, had no existence during that time. You had tiny little tribal groupings with some city as their fortified defense point, and that was all. And the first man who organized it into a kingdom of Egypt, their first king, Menes. Now, getting his date is a bit of a problem. The Egyptian priests were the ones who kept the records, the history. And they falsified dates from time to time as might suit their purpose. But one of the pharaohs commissioned a very intelligent, well-educated, and able Egyptian priest named Manetho to write an exact history of Egypt. Now, unfortunately, there is not in existence today any copy of Manetho's history, nor any scrap or fragment of it. What we have today is quotations in various early writers, most of them Greeks, saying that Manetho said this or that, and they give a quotation from Manetho. That's all we've got. And unfortunately, due to either their carelessness or their being inveterate liars, they don't bother quoting Manetho to the same effect. Manetho listed each of the successive dynasties, the length of time that a particular family continued in power, handing down the throne from generation to generation. And with he lists the total length of time that each dynasty was in power with the length of time of each king of that dynasty ruling. Now, according to some of these people, quoting Manetho, Menes, the first king, might have been as late as 3200 BC. According to some of the others, he might have been as early as 5700 BC, and a few assorted spots in between. Possibly about 3400 BC is as good a guess as you can get. But Menes definitely conquered and reduced to control as one kingdom, Egypt. And he was the first king of the first dynasty in Egypt. Now, tombs of kings in this first dynasty, and going back pretty close to Menes himself, have been discovered and opened by archaeologists. And papyrus writings and carvings and paintings on the wall and that sort of thing have given evidence that the earliest dynasties were Aryan. Now, during all the thousands of years of Egypt's greatness, Egypt was definitely a white nation. in Africa, but not of Africa. They have found, of course, a great many mummies, so well preserved that the hair, the texture of the skin, and so on can be determined from it. And going back to the early days of Egypt's greatness, well, the first six dynasties were the golden age of Egyptian history. That's when they had their greatest builders and their greatest sculptors and that sort of thing. And of all the mummies found, not over 2% showed any Negroid characteristics. None that would appear to be full-blood Negro, but I mean not over 2% indicated there could possibly have been any admixture. Now, I may have told you this before. The earliest Egyptians had a very high monotheistic religion. Sure, it became as debased as anything you could find later, after the niggers got in. But some of the early Egyptian hymns, for example, would compare favorably with those you find in the Book of Psalms. There's one, for example, speaking of their one God, which says, "No man has seen his likeness. No statue can be made of him. He doesn't dwell in any temple. All the earth couldn't contain him." In other words, idolatry was definitely out. As part of their high religion, they did believe in resurrection. But they thought there had to be something there to resurrect. Now, we know that if your body, well, if it were destroyed chemically, just returned to the original atoms of which it was made, that wouldn't interfere in the least with your resurrection. When God wants you back here, he'll provide you a new body. But that wasn't the way the Egyptians understood the matter of resurrection. There had to be something. It would need a repair job, of course, but there had to be something there to resurrect. So they mummified the dead and felt, well, if resurrection isn't too long delayed, why, the mummy will be there to be resurrected. However, nobody knew the date. Might be in 100 years, might be in 50,000 years. And they realized that with the best of their skill, their mummies were not going to last forever. So royalty and the wealthy and so on provided for that contingency too. In the tomb with the mummy, they provided a portrait sculpture of the deceased. Now, we have some beautiful sculpture from the Greeks, but very little of it is portrait sculpture. Nearly all of it is just the sculptor's idea of what a well-muscled person would look like. He probably took the arms and shoulders from one model and the legs from another and so on to get what he considered an ideal physical type. And the faces are left blank, stupid, idiotic. On very few Greek statues do they ever even bother indicating the pupil of the eye. It stands there, a slack face, staring out vacantly. No indication that any thought was ever inside that skull. No indication that any life had brought the markings of character to that face. It wasn't a portrait of an individual, except in rare instances. But the art of portrait sculpture has never been raised higher than among the Egyptians, because what good would it do you to have in your tomb a statue of some other man, not yourself, to get his resurrection? That wouldn't get you your resurrection if your mummy was too far gone. So here were these portrait statues, and they show definitely a white person. They have the narrow-bridged high nose and thin narrow nostrils, the thin lips of the typical white man. The bulk of their population were of the Mediterranean type, although at times they had a Nordic aristocracy ruling over them, as they did in the first six dynasties, at least, when they had the golden age of Egyptian history. They even, in many instances, painted these statues, and they were so careful to be realistic. If it was a man, his skin was painted a slightly darker color. Not the skin color of any of the colored races, but just a white man with a little suntan. The woman, of course, was doing her work inside the house, but the man was out in the fields of this hot, semi-tropical country, directing the work of his slave laborers out there, and he got sunburned, and it showed it. But always, this confirms, as do the mummies, that here was a pure white race during all the time of Egypt's greatness. In fact, during that time, free Negroes were not allowed in Egypt. They had Negro slaves working in chains out in the fields, yes. The Nile River, remember, was not navigable from Nubia to the south of Egypt, on down into Egypt, because there were cataracts up there. They couldn't come in by ship. They would have to stop, unload, portage, and so on. And there was no supply arrangement whereby you could bring in a Nubian army with all the supplies they needed through a desert or semi-desert land. South of Egypt, and the south border originally was at what today we call Assuan. Bible speaks of it as Syene, first cataract of the Nile. The border was there. South of that lay what today we call the Sudan. In those days they called it Nubia, and south of that was Ethiopia. So they did have provision that Negro merchants were permitted to come to the south border of Egypt and a short distance in for trade, carrying such goods as they might bring and to pick up Egyptian goods to take back. But they were forbidden to have any shipping on the Nile River. Now, farther down, the Nile became quite navigable. There's records of some of these ancient Egyptian Nile River ships being as much as 140 feet long. But the Negroes had no way of getting through there. Then gradually, Egypt began expanding south. From the time of Menes, about 3400 BC, to the time of Pharaoh Zoser, 2980 BC, the southern frontier had been pushed 75 miles south of the first cataract. Then Sesostris III of the 12th dynasty came to the throne in 1887 BC. And in his reign, he completed the conquest of Nubia. So you had it now conquered, occupied, and ruled by Egyptians. But the trouble was, even earlier than that, the gate had been opened. Beginning with Pharaoh Pepi I, 2450 BC, thousands of these Nubian Negroes had been conscripted into Egyptian armies. Egyptian history tells how they were attacked occasionally from Libya to the west of them on the Mediterranean coast, and that wasn't too tough. They beat that off pretty easily. But they were getting rather persistent attacks from nomadic peoples in the desert lands to the east of them on the Asian mainland. And they were having to make quite a battle in these early days. That was before Egyptian expansion, to beat back these nomadic, probably Arab peoples. So they started conscripting into the Egyptian army, training and arming them to use against the Arabs, tens and scores of thousands of these Nubian Negroes. Now the Nubian, like any other Negro, made a pretty docile slave. He'd do what he was told if you made it clear you meant it, and he'd better do it or else. And similarly, he was a soldier who would take orders and never do any thinking about why. But here was the beginning of the downfall of Egypt. Remember that no throne was very secure in those days, and especially when the king died and his eldest son, at the age of 15, inherited the throne. Now what? Did he have enough loyal officers surrounding him to hold it for him? If not, the throne was up for grabs. And the military commander, the general in command of a large force of trained and armed Nubian Negroes, he had the ready-made means of seizing power. Because they wouldn't ask any questions. When he told them, go in and fight the rest of the Egyptians here, they'd do it. That's what they got to pay for. So you had the beginning of trouble in there. In fact, it reached the point where the Egyptian word for soldier, matoi, was derived from mazoi, the name of a Nubian Negro tribe that furnished most of their soldiers. Well, dynasties 18 through 25 show the decay and fall of Egypt. Now, dynasty 18, beginning 1580 BC, came just after the Hyksos, the shepherd kings, were expelled. Now, Joseph went down into Egypt, taken in there and sold into slavery, you remember, in the 1700s B.C., when there were still Hyksos shepherd kings on the throne. Now, they were not Israelites, but they were his cousins, Adamites. They were his type of people, and that's why he made such rapid progress among them. Then you remember the Bible says that there came a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph and began the oppression of the people of Israel there, so that you had gotten down into this 18th dynasty. The exodus from Egypt was roughly a century after the 18th dynasty came to the throne. They started the beginning of the 18th dynasty with Egypt in full power. Pharaoh Shishak the First, your Bible calls him Shishak, who founded the 22nd dynasty, was a Libyan mercenary general who had come to the throne through the aid of these Nubian troops. But Egypt, for a long period there, was the great empire of the ancient world. Their frontier was on the Euphrates River a great part of the time. They had conquered Palestine, they had conquered Syria, they conquered Babylonia. And you found Egyptian armies on the Euphrates River a great deal more of the time than you found Babylonian or Assyrian armies penetrating into Egyptian territory. So this is what you had under a people who were still predominantly white. But decay was setting in, the beginnings of mongrelization, and they started going down. Nubia became independent. Now, the Egyptian religion had become utterly corrupted by this time. They worshipped a multitude of gods. You know, you've seen pictures of their gods, a human body with the head of a jackal or of a bird or something of the sort. And it takes a pretty bird-brained people to worship a bird-brained god. And occasionally a pharaoh would try to restore the ancient high religion. And of course he had all the priests trying to get the people to rise in rebellion against him. So besides the competition of different claimants to the throne, you had this religious turmoil too. And about 775 B.C., a Nubian mulatto king, Shabaka, invaded Egypt. Here it was divided. The priests were on his side because he had their same religion. And they pulled some of the army over to join with him. And he conquered Egypt and became king. And for something a little over a century, you had Egypt ruled by mulatto kings held in power by Nubian Negro armies holding down a conquered people. This Negro dynasty and their armies were expelled from Egypt by the Assyrian king, Esarhaddon, between 673 and 670 B.C. But by that time, all Egypt was mulatto. Now, where Egypt, as I say, had been the great ruling power, and her frontier was on the Euphrates River, she was sinking into insignificance, and the armies of Babylon and of Assyria were invading Palestine and Syria, conquering the little kingdoms there which had been tributary to Egypt before, and making them tributary to Babylon and Assyria. Now the pharaohs wanted the invading Babylonians and Assyrians kept as great a distance away as they could, and they were always encouraging these little kingdoms in Palestine and Syria to rebel against Babylonian or Assyrian overlords and promising them military aid. But you remember now that Isaiah, writing during the 700s B.C., and Jeremiah, writing during the late 600s and early 500s B.C., kept warning the people and the kings of Judah and of Israel, don't you depend upon Pharaoh's promises to send you one of these mulatto armies. He said, you've been promised this. They said they'll give you military support, but don't you do it. They won't be able to help you. Already, Egypt had fallen. From then on, yes, they lived among great buildings falling into ruin because nobody was enterprising enough to keep them in repair. They worshipped in dilapidated temples put up by their ancestors who were white. They had no literature to speak of. Art went to practically nothing. And any military adventurer who came along at the head of an army of about 20,000 well-trained troops could take the thing over and make himself king. So you've got the invariable lesson of history. Wherever you find the white race living in contact with a black race or a yellow race, mongrelization follows, and with it the white race perishes by becoming part of the dark ones. You remember when the people were on the march in the Exodus, just before they went into Palestine, God gave them the most explicit instructions. These people who live in the land that I am giving to you, you shall not leave one man, woman, or child alive. Not one. You shall exterminate them totally. He said, because if you don't, you're going to have integration. Your children will grow up with their children. They'll intermarry, and you'll become as polluted as these others until finally I will have to destroy you for the same reason that I am telling you to destroy them. God warned us never to tolerate a situation where we live in contact with one of these other races, because mongrelization would be the penalty. Now let's take one more example, or set of examples, on our own continent. Mexico, Central, and South America was settled by Europeans a full century before any of the earliest settlements in the United States or Canada. They had a 400 years head start on us. They had an equally rich land. South America is one of the richest lands in the world, potentially. Their mineral wealth is beyond estimation. Their arable land is greater than our own. A smaller proportion of it is desert than here in North America. So that they should be wealthy, highly developed, 100 years ahead of us. But what happened? The United States and Canada were settled by people who came over here as white men wanting to escape the tyranny at home. They came here to settle. They brought their families. They wanted to live in liberty in a land which they had set up in their own fashion. They didn't mongrelize with the Indians to any noticeable extent. There was constant fighting with the Indians, whom they drove out before them. So you had here a pure white race developing, building the high civilization that you could expect. But now, from Mexico down through Central and South America, who are the white nations who conquered there? Spain and Portugal. And those were nations already mongrelized. Now, perfectly true that you had one of the earliest of the Israel peoples on the march, a Germanic people, the Vandals. They came down into Italy and they weren't impressed by the great monuments that the Romans had built. And they busted things up considerably before they went on. And the Romans, ever since then, have not had a good word to say for the Vandals. We still use that word for somebody who goes around breaking up things. But remember, that was part of our job, to break up these empires of the Babylonian succession. And the Vandals crossed through southern France and over the Pyrenees and down into Spain. The province of Spain, which today we call Andalusia, was originally called Vandalusia, where they settled there. Then later, you remember the Visigoths captured and looted the city of Rome in 410 A.D. Then they moved out, 2 or 3 years later, crossed southern France and the Pyrenees, down into Spain and Portugal, where they became the ruling aristocracy. Now, the Vandals, while they were a ruling aristocracy, did not exterminate or drive out the original inhabitants of Spain and Portugal. And as the Goths came in, the Vandals moved out into northern Africa, where they disappeared by mongrelization with the African peoples. But you had
the Visigoths
from, say, 425, perhaps, A.D., as the ruling aristocracy until the Moorish conquest began in 711 A.D. The Moors came in, this white aristocracy, Nordic aristocracy, fought a bitter rearguard action all the way back into fastnesses in the valleys of the Pyrenees Mountains. And you had in northern Spain and some of Portugal, the easiest to defend portions, you still had this Nordic aristocracy, Israel people. But they were few. There are some survivors of them today. And from 711 to 1492 A.D., you had Spain and Portugal occupied by the Moors. And with all those centuries in there, you had a good deal of mongrelization. The Moors were driven out of the last portion of Spain in 1492 A.D. Well, Spain and Portugal were ruled by a military aristocracy, ruling over an already mongrelized people. It took a lot of money to keep the king and those at his court in one continuous debauch the whole year round, without ever having to get fully sober or to interrupt their gambling and that sort of thing. And they had taxed their people to the point of utter poverty. But when they discovered what was on this continent, the original inhabitants here, over thousands of years, had gathered together quite a bit of wealth of gold and silver. As that was discovered, you remember, the Spaniards and Portuguese sent their expeditions in there. They were nothing but robbers coming to loot. They weren't coming to settle. They didn't bring their wives along. They were nothing but common thieves, or maybe uncommon thieves, stealing on a bigger scale. They're purely to loot. And you remember the shipload after shipload after shipload of gold and silver they sent back to Spain and Portugal.